This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and we call the show Main Street because it is the time and place that we come together, we greet our friends, we say hello, we talk about the weather, whatever is going on in our lives. And right now, of course, it is the Friday before Christmas. So there's a lot to talk about there. Maybe we've eaten too much. Maybe we're really excited to see family. This is a time of feasting, family, and faith. We are revisiting a conversation from October of this year about the St. John's Bible, one of the most significant artistic achievements of this century, is on display after more than a decade and a half of work. The St. John's Bible features hand-calligraphed text and unique works of art. It also offers a modern look at Scripture, one that highlights gender equality and celebrates racial diversity, science, and other topics. It's the lifelong dream of calligrapher and scribe Donald Jackson, who teamed up with St. John's University in Minnesota to bring the project to life. Nearly 70 pages of text are on display at the Yumcom Center in Moorhead, Minnesota. I spoke with the director of the St. John's Bible Project, Tim Turnus, back in October. Tim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We are standing in front of a remarkable piece of history and art and literature that is the St. John's Bible. I just want to start with sort of the feeling, the emotion. What happens in your mind and in your heart when you think about the St. John's Bible?
Well, the first thing that strikes people when they come and see it is the magnitude of the work. It's large. You know, when you look at the Bible, you think of the Bible, you often think of that little thing that's in the hotel room drawer, this little tiny book, and this is so not that. And when people come and see it, the first thing they go is like, wow, it's so big. And the next thing they say, oh my gosh, look at the color. And then it starts to sink into them that every dot, every curl, every letter, every piece of paint has been put on by hand. And that gives people pause. Because if you think about it, everyone can write. We can all make letters. But I can't do what's on the page in front of me. And that's really what gives people that wow. It's that sense of this is so different than anything I even expected.
It's interesting that you still have that feeling. This is an idea that was first floated out as early as 1970, and then work really began in earnest in the mid-90s. This has been a long time coming, and you still feel that sort of glory when you talk about it?
Every time I encounter it, it always changes because the viewer changes. I change. The people I'm looking at it with changes. That's the beauty of this of the St. John's Bible. It's a static thing, but it doesn't remain static when it becomes communal and we engage with it. And that's really why it was done.
Why this size?
That's a very good question. Go back to that little book I talked about in the hotel room drawer. That book is sized for you. It is a personal book. It's something you carry with you. This book, because of its size, says, you can't even lift me by yourself. It's not meant for you. The Bible is communal. It's meant for everyone. And so the structure, the size is communal. And that's also why the Bible is not new words. We did not retranslate the Bible. It's a standard translation, the NRSV translation, the New Revised Standard Version. When we decided to do this with the artistic team, we said we'll do it, but it has to be a literal translation, it has to be a scholarly translation, it has to be an inclusive translation, and it has to be a translation in English. But for the most important thing, because of the idea of the communal nature of the word, It had to be a translation that was used by more than just the Catholic Church. But we chose the NRSV because it happens to be literal, happens to be scholarly, happens to be very inclusive. But for our purposes, the most important feature of the NRSV is the fact that it is one of the few translations of the Bible in English that is officially approved by almost every major Christian church worldwide. And as a result now, we have a Bible where people from all types of traditions, even non-Christian traditions, are coming together and enjoying it and using it together. But it is a new visual translation. And it's the artworks that also serve to remind you that the Bible is communal. So the whole thing, word and image, is designed to think of it as a visual spiritual meditation designed to invite you into the Scriptures. And we feel the most powerful way to do that is to do that with others, that whole idea of community. These artworks say, bring somebody else along, talk about it, and tell us what you see.
Let us pore over this together. Can you paint a mental image of what this first page of Genesis looks like?
Okay, you and I are standing in front of the opening of the book of Genesis. So you've got on the right side, beautiful hand-calligraphed text. And when I mean hand-calligraphed, I mean painstakingly every letter written with hand-ground inks using a turkey, swan, or goose quill. A page that we're looking at would have taken between 7 to 13 hours to write. And that beautiful, elegant blue text that you see in a solid column, decorated with gold, 24-karat gold squares that denote the paragraph markings, really present the text in an elegant way. Paired with that, then, because this is, of course, the story of creation, the 7 days of creation, paired with that, on the left-hand side, you're going to see this strikingly powerful, contemporary, but not New Age, image of creation. When we did the St. John's Bible, we wanted to make sure that the artwork not only represented the scripture passages, but brought in how we think about things today, brought in current technology, current thinking, but also at the same time stayed true to the text. Mm-hmm. So we needed to bring these into the 21st century. The first thing the artist did was to make it somewhat literal. You see seven vertical slices. Why seven? That's pretty obvious. One for each day. And how did the story begin? It begins in darkness and chaos. So the artwork begins in a chaotic, dark mess. But if you look within that mess, you'll see elegant Hebrew lettering. In the beginning was the word. A tiny gold band of light shatters that darkness. Boom, creation begins. You see mathematical fractals. So these jagged edges that are mixed within that chaos, because in the current world, we understand that there was chaos, but there was also a mathematical order about to be brought forth. And then the pieces continue to open up. The second slice showing you blue, grays, this mix together, the creation of heavens and the seas. In the third slice, you see what looks to be like a topographical map from the satellite. It happens to be an image of the Ganges River Delta. You've got the idea of earth and water separating. Then you have the sun to rule by day and the moon to rule by night on the next strip, with a 24-karat gold circle of the sun and a slightly silvered and gold circle for the moon. Then you have creation of birds and fish. And then finally on the sixth stripe, you have human beings. And they're very primitive. Their structure is taken from cave paintings and aboriginal paintings and rock paintings. And we have an image of a huntress on the very first page. It happens to be one of the oldest images of a woman we have on the planet. Because, of course, in today's world, we understand the equality of men and women. So we begin with a beautiful image, an ancient image of a woman on our page. And then you go into this 24-karat gold band, that day of rest. And all the way through it, you have these tiny gold squares that connect the days, that build a ladder, that lead us from creation, from chaos to order. And you can't help but look at it by thinking and stop and go wondering, wow, what will this say today? What does this say in 500 years? And how will people look at this in 1,000 years?
Yeah. Well, let's walk over. There are nearly 70 pages from the Bible in display in total. And as we are talking about inclusivity, I want to bring us in front of a page where we are talking about Jesus. Mm-hmm. But the artist behind this exact piece went to the Cleveland Farmers Market and started talking to vendors about what in their tradition do they call the creator, the higher up, the power. Walk us through the resulting image.
We're standing in front of a piece by artist Suzanne Moore from Washington State. And when she was given this piece from the letter of Paul to the Philippians, it's commonly known as the Gnosis Hymn, she focused on how do I bring this text to life? And she ended up meditating on the very last part. It says, and that every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. And she got hung up on that, every tongue should confess. And she thought, there's my hook. And so she went to the market and she started to talk to people. And she found people who spoke all these different languages right within, you know, just blocks of where she lives. And she said, how do you say Jesus Christ or Lord in your language? And what she then did is she took those words and she got words from, of course, English, Greek, French, Armenian, Japanese, Vietnamese, German, Coptic, Portuguese, Italian, Russian, Korean, and even Ethiopian Ge'ez. And what she did then is she wrote those words in beautiful, large, calligraphic, stylistic letters and gilded them in 24-karat gold. And then on top of this beautiful bed of multicultural languages, she wrote the words of the prayer of the Gnosis hymn. And what you have is this just graceful passage that creates this visual representation of all the tongues coming together to praise God. And it's just, it draws you in. And what's also wonderful, as you approach the page, you don't see the gold, but then you walk past and you hit a different angle of the light, and all of a sudden, all you can see are the gold multi-language words. It's pretty powerful.
Well, and even in different levels of light here, different words are highlighted. You are absolutely forced to move yourself to really take in this image.
When you read the St. John's Bible, you don't just read it and close it. You engage your entire body. And it's a pretty, it's a very sensual thing. That's not often you say that about the Bible.
No, I want to go there with you. What do you mean by sensual experience?
Because it does engage you. Because of its fierce size, your body physically moves differently to turn the pages. Because of what you have to read, your whole head has to move to go down the page. Because of the gold, you do move your body to get that light as well. But you, now of course you can't feel it here, because it's behind the case. But in the real thing, you feel this, not paper, you feel this textured skin. It's calf skin. And so there is a different weight to that. And when you turn it, there is a snap and a movement that the sound vellum makes is very different. I've done almost everything but lick the pages. I don't know what they taste like. But I'll tell you, it is a very different experience when you explore this book.
Do you have any idea how many times you've explored the St. John's Bible?
Well, I began working with the St. John's Bible 14 years ago. And about midway, I stopped keeping count when I hit 2,700 presentations. I'm not kidding. And that was several years ago. I think I've talked about the St. John's Bible more than anybody else. I am the keeper of the pages and the keeper of the story.
In terms of just the mechanics of keeping the pages, what are the precautions that you need to take?
Well, the pages are fugitive, and that's a word we use in the art world, that they can deteriorate over time. But the materials we chose, the vellum, the pigments that are made of soot, the hand ground lapis and the hand ground vermilion for the inks have been proven centuries ago. You can see books made of the exact same materials that are 600, 700, and 800 years old. And those books in the case were not in a museum for 600 years. They were used. However, we want to take care of it. So you'll notice when you come to the exhibition, light levels are low. We mitigate light damage because light damage is permanent and you can't reverse it. Another thing, they're encased. They're kept at about 45% humidity and at 68 degrees. They are encased and they're sealed in these hyper-clean cases. We're looking for this to last 2,000 years or even longer.
What kind of insurance policy do you have?
We have 150-some monks praying for it every day. We're set. We're set. We actually have a very good insurance policy. It's treated just like any standard artwork as well.
How has your relationship with the Bible changed in the years that you've been working on this? Was it 14 years?
One thing that has really changed on the way I view the Bible is how truly communal it needs to be. So many people make the Bible a very personal thing. Nothing wrong with that. But it becomes so much richer when you realize the communal power of the word, and that I have the rare privilege of going around the country, throughout Europe, parts of Canada, and many other places as well, talking about these well-known passages and hearing about those from not only Christians, but Jews and Muslims and people who have no faith at all and people who hate faith and hate church. But at some point in time, they come together and they've all just been wowed by this project. And that, I think, has really changed the way I look at scriptures and the way I look at sharing scriptures. Mm-hmm. Scripture is not something I read personally anymore. Even when I read it by myself, I always read it with that communal nature in mind. And that's been a transformation.
Have you gotten any backlash on this? I mean, there are people who would be deeply offended by the fact that we are sitting in front of the passage, love is patient, love is kind, and it is in the rainbow flag, which is a symbol for inclusivity in love and that it is not just heterosexual. Have you gotten blowback for putting things like this in the St. John's Bible?
No, because there's nothing there that says this is what it means. The artworks are there for you to interpret with others. And some people will see what you said. Some people will see this wash of color. Some people see the rainbow as a covenant sign. People will bring to them with them their own theology. And they'll discover other people's theology with it. We did have one person who did not like our Adam and Eve. And I said, well, what don't you like about it? She said, well, they don't look like me. And they're a beautiful African couple that are on this page, where I've also had this beautiful young little woman in Omaha that looked at that and had tears in her eyes because she said, it's the first time I've seen an Adam and Eve that look like me. People are going to bring their own things to it, and that's the richness of it.
Zooming ahead 2,000 years, do you even want to try to speculate what might be different in the world based on a presentation of the Bible like this? Or you could do the opposite question. If this had been the Bible that we all studied, do you think the world would be a whole lot different?
I can't project. I can't go back either. But one thing I have noticed with this project, which is so different, you know, I have seen many people hold the Bible in their hand, their finger pointing on it, and using it in a way that says, here is what I understand, and here's what it says about you. Mm-hmm. This is the first time I have encountered something in the religious world. I have seen people who are very liberal absolutely love this project. But I've also seen people who are ultra-conservative come and say, this is fantastic. Now, when have you encountered something in the recent world where both sides of the polarization come together and say, this is great? That alone is miraculous, I think, as well, as we look at this project. And that's kind of a trite thing to talk about. But I love the way that the St. John's Bible crosses all these boundaries. And that's also going to change. People will see these pages differently now and in 1,000 years, and that's how it should be. If it's static, it doesn't have any meaning.
Tim, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
It took 8 years for the Yom Kamps to secure that exhibit, the largest in the museum's history. It's on display through the end of the year only, and then those pages will join hundreds of other pages and be bound in a book. And after that, there will only be a couple pages on display at a time in their permanent home at St. John's University in Collegeville, Minnesota. Coming up next on Main Street, a Native interpretation of The Night Before Christmas.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. The question, why, is very empowering. It's about the divine, it's about the moral, it's about the pleasurable, it's about fear. Why is everything? I'm not very good with authority, and I'm not very good with limits. And so I like a question that gives me the ability to do whatever I want, whenever I want. I was born and raised in Manhattan, on the edge of a neighborhood that most people would know as Spanish Harlem. I ended up in North Dakota because they offered me a job. It's that simple. And we've had a very good life here so far. Dispel these myths. Philosophy is boring. I guess I would ask you to ask yourself, are you boring? Do you think you have nothing of interest to offer anybody? You are philosophy. Philosophy is you. Everything you ask, everything you think, everything you want, everything you strive for, this is what makes up philosophy. Philosophy itself is compelling enough and exciting enough that it is pretty much the oldest discipline. And philosophers had more influence on the world than almost anybody. Plato, Aristotle, we live in their world. And so if you want to make philosophy exciting, you have to be exciting. Philosophy majors can't get jobs or make any money. Philosophy is the highest paid major of all of the humanities, and the rate of return is actually the same over a lifetime as engineering. Listen to Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life, every second Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, 4 Mountain, on Prairie Public.
Hi, this is Bill Thomas at Prairie Public. You're listening, so you must like us, so you probably want to know all the ways you can listen. You can listen on the radio. Traditionally, you can be a modern and load the Prairie Public app on your smartphone or tablet. You can be cosmopolitan and use TuneIn or iHeartRadio, or maybe you want to be a hipster. You can listen to NPR One. However you like to listen, we're glad to have you.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Native American Night Before Christmas is a book from writer, filmmaker, and photographer Gary Robinson, who runs Tribal Eye Productions. Here he is reading the poem.
'Twas the night before Christmas, when all through the teepee, not a creature was stirring, nothing crawly, nothing creepy. The moccasins were hung from the lodge poles with care, in hopes that old Red Shirt soon would be there. The kids were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of choke cherries danced in their heads. And I in my Pendleton, and Ma in her skins, had just cuddled up cozy against cold winter winds. When out in the camp rose a noise so humongous, I thought a wildcat had sneaked in among us. Up I jumped and ran through the clutter, threw back the flap, and made the lodge shudder. The moon and the stars in the night sky were blinking, like the headlight that shines on my 69 Lincoln. When what to my wondering eyes did show but an old wooden sleigh and 8 buffalo, with a plump little driver who was so well fed, I thought for a minute it was flying fry bread. Like thundering clouds, these mammoths, they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by name. Now Harjo, now Redbo, now Chino and Soodle, on Tall Chief, on Jim Boy, on White Cloud and Serpahoodle. To the top of the trees, to the top of the bushes, he yelled, "Haul your fur and move your tushes." Like pine cones caught and tossed by a whirlwind and suspended in air by the magic of medicine, up to the lodge top, the bison, they flew, with a sleigh full of commodities, and the old Indian, too. Then in a moment they froze there in space, and I felt all the color drain from my face. I turned back inside just as quick as a wink, as down the smoke hole old Red Shirt did sink. He was dressed in red buckskins from his head to his foot, with beadwork and fringe. He really looked good. A medicine bundle he had by his side, on his back, a large bag made of buffalo hide.
A headdress he wore as tall as a crown, made of white turkey feathers, all tipped in brown.
His skin was as wrinkled as sun-baked earth, but none of these things told of his worth. He spoke not a word, but used sign language instead, and filled all the moccasin with toys and fry bread. And then, like smoke rising into the night, he gave me a wink and took to his flight. Up through the smoke hole, into the sleigh, awaken his team with a hearty hokahay. And I heard him exclaim as they thundered out of sight, "Merry Christmas to all my relations, and to all a good night."
Native American Night Before Christmas is available on Amazon. It won the 2010 Moonbeam Award for Holiday Books. Still to come on Main Street, a movie review from Madeline, but up next, German-Russian Christmas traditions.
The Pulse is a Saturday afternoon radio show about health. Sounds like a pretty dry topic, right?
It can be devastatingly boring.
That's the host of The Pulse, Mike and Scott.
So we are just trying to give people answers to some basic questions and to cut through some of this dense language that always seems to surround healthcare.
So, Mike, and it seems like The Pulse is cultivating a young audience, what with your down-to-earth hosting style and snappy production. But I'm wondering how you get young folks to actually care about health.
I just had a funny discussion with a lot of my coworkers who are millennials, and they said, "Stop looking at us all the time. Stop trying to analyze us and figure out what we do." So I think a good story is a good story
Okay, Mike, and so how do you make a program about healthcare accessible?
Many of the issues we report on can be really hard to understand. I think it always comes back to people, finding the people who either are living through a moment or are really passionate about a topic.
So what was your most intense moment on the show?
We recently met a young couple where the husband has brain cancer. They had this moment where the woman suddenly said to her husband, "I can't see us getting old together." And then she started crying. It feels very special that they trust us with that kind of moment.
Catch the informative and highly entertaining new program on Prairie Public, The Pulse, Saturday afternoons at 2 Central, 1 Mountain.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. As we head into the Christmas weekend, we're likely to start remembering our early Christmas traditions. Memories have a funny way of changing one year to the next, or even one person to the next, which is one reason it's so important to collect them before it's too late. The Dakota Memories Oral History Project comes from the Germans from Russia Heritage Collection at the Libraries of North Dakota State University. We're airing an excerpt from the German-Russian Childhood Memories Holiday Special with narrator Meryl Pepcorn.
Like any other Christian immigrant, when the Germans from Russia got here, they brought along their holiday traditions, including the ones for Christmas and the New Year. The Dakota Memories Oral History Interviewers got people like Mary Vetter Shell Smith to talk about the old days.
And like if there was a lot of snow or something, they would all get into a big sled or something. And they would come in on Christmas Eve, they would come in. And we have what they call a Christkindl.
And we can all share with them some stories about Christmas back then. They were picking up some traditions from the general American culture, but still had many distinctively German ways. Here's Jessica Clark, who coordinates the Dakota Memories Oral History Project, on how things were in the 1930s and 40s when the people they interviewed were children.
With the second and third generation Germans from Russia, there's a little bit of acculturation that you see taking place into American society and American life with traditions, but you also see the maintaining of traditional German-Russian cultures. So you have, especially in the second and third generation, when you approach the 1930s and 1940s, you have more of an integration or a mix of both. For instance, the one that really comes to mind right now is the practice of the Belzenigel and the Christ Child or Christkindl. Many second and third generations remember those figures being present in their Christmas celebration. But then again, some of them will also remember Santa Claus as well. One narrator in particular, Balzer Kurtz, he discussed his memories of all three in his childhood. First, the Belzenigel would appear, and he would be this scary guy that would carry whips and just frighten the children. And then about a week, maybe two later, the Christkindl would appear. And this would be a woman. That person would bring treats for the kids. And then about 1 week later, Santa Claus appeared with toys.
Peter Coker remembers decorations and a favorite present, how much just a book could mean to a child. But listen as he describes what he calls Santa Claus and Mrs. Claus. This is not the elf with the reindeer, but instead a different tradition, as you'll hear.
Oh, we had our own family Christmas. The girls always decorated the living room mostly. We had a large living room down there. And I wish we'd still have those decorations, but we don't. It's stringing from one corner to the other, and then that way. And they had big bells that you could open up, you know. They'd hang them up. And actually, we had a bought Christmas tree, but it was real simple. You put candles on there. So we had a pretty good Christmas. And even, well, that time they had Santa Claus. Usually it was somebody local, or even my older brother was. Yeah, my brother John. He was dressed up, I don't know how he is. Big overcoat or whatever. And they were going to take me outside. I was maybe 8, 10 years old. give me a whipping, you know, with that dead willow wreaths. You were mean, you were naughty. Yeah. And anyway, and the other Joe, he was dressed up like a lady. It was like Mrs. Santa Claus. They had a name for it. Santa Claus was Bilsenige. Christine, she was the woman, you know, his wife. But that was just local. I mean, he did it just for us. Other families had their own thing. Then we got a little gift. I still remember getting, I don't think anything cost more than 25 cents. But then in those days, that was quite a bit. I know one year, my mother bought me, usually it was the mother that did the buying, a Boy Scout book. Everything that Boy Scouts do, learn, you know, tie knots and whatever, learn all the names of trees and birds. And I don't know, I had that for many years. Otherwise, I can't remember nothing much. That hit me pretty good, that book. I liked that book.
The people, the holiday figures that Mr. Coker remembers, are usually called the Belzenigel and the Christkindl.
Well, the Belzenigel and the Christkindl were probably the most fascinating for me because it's something that, not being myself German-Russian, I didn't know much about.
Jessica Clark again.
And then to hear about the variations, and it doesn't seem to be a variation based on religion, because with the Germans from Russia, there are Catholics and there are Protestants, and they have very different practices. But that doesn't seem to mesh with why they're different in how they recall their memories of the Belzenigel or the Christkindl. Some remember the Belzenigel being scary, but yet leaving the goodie bag behind as well. You know, so they never had that Christkindl bringing in a goodie bag. Some remember the Belzenigel carrying huge chains and wearing fur and looking like a monster. Others remember him as just being, you know, somebody making noise out in another room and never really having a face or a figure to put with it. They just knew that a scary monster named the Belzenigel was outside our door.
Valeria Wagner-Sane talks here about how her family practiced this tradition.
We always go to midnight mass at Christmas time. And on Christmas Eve, of course, Santa Claus would come, you know, and you got to just open your gifts then and play around for a while, and then the little ones had to go to bed. An older one would stay with them. That's an evening not everybody went to church all the time because of the weather. And out in the country, you couldn't always have midnight mass, so we just had our regular Santa Claus time, and the Christkindl would come. That would be somebody different. See, instead of Santa Claus kind of, they had Christkindl come, and she would bring you your gift. And two angels would usually be with her. I really don't know how they would really explain that. And Santa, instead of Santa Claus, they had the Bilsenigel. And that was a guy that would be dressed up looking kind of like a mean bear, almost sort of in dark fur coats and whatever, have a chain on his leg, and somebody would hold the chain so he wouldn't get away. He'd be the guy to, and come for the mean children. And that scared some kids, so that kind of died out as we got older. So we never really got into it that we would ask a whole lot of questions. We were just glad to get rid of him. When we got a little older, we had Santa Claus come. And so Santa Claus would bring our gifts, and there was no more of this Christkindl coming anymore, and the angels would come and sing. They would sing the Christmas carols. They looked pretty. They had white gowns on, probably wedding dresses or whatever, and they'd have wings, and they looked like they were covered with real white feathers. They were just beautiful. And some of those angels were some of our neighbors that we knew, but we didn't know that until we got older, that it was the girls, you know, from the neighbor family. And they would sing Christmas carols in German, mostly, like Silent Night and all those. I still like Silent Night as my favorite Christmas song. Oh, I just about die when they don't sing it often enough during Christmas.
That was an excerpt from the German-Russian Childhood Memories Holiday Special. The whole show is on a CD featuring stories from more than 20 narrators who grew up on the Northern Plains. It's available on our website. Coming up next, a movie review from Matt O'Lean.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
When you hear the fanfare, you know it is time for a movie review. Matt, normally I do a little bit of research on these films to try and ask good questions. I watch the trailer. I get prepared. I am so opposed to any spoilers for the new Star Wars that I didn't even do any research on this. So it's all on you.
Just wind me up and let me go.
But if you do any spoilers, I will force choke you.
Okay.
So
without even moving, I bet you can do that.
Well, I mean, that's what force choking is.
That's an interesting thing in the film that people might see. The Last Jedi, huge box office opening, as predicted, over $200 million. Don't know if it's going to beat Force Awakens for total gross. We will see in the next few weeks. But
what'd that one open at?
I don't remember, but it broke the box office record. Okay. It broke the all-time box office record. When it was done, it did pass Avatar. So this picks up where the last film left off. We're not going to talk about Rogue One, which was sort of this standalone film last year. And once again, the new characters have been very well cast. Daisy Ridley is Rey. You have John Boyega, Oscar Isaac. So it's a nod to the past because we had Harrison Ford in the last film, Carrie Fisher in her farewell performance in this film. Mark Hamill is now back as Luke Skywalker. So it's a nod to the past while going toward the future with these new characters. And I think it works fairly well with those new characters. Adam Driver, really good as Kylo Ren. I think he's really almost the driving force, along with Rey, of this new trilogy. And the relationship between Kylo Ren and Rey is very interesting. And again, we're not going to do spoilers here, but that is a very big part of this film, The Last Jedi, and the use of the Force and things like that. So that was quite interesting how they played up this relationship between those two characters. Mark Hamill, you know, weathered, worn as Luke Skywalker, and of course Daisy Ridley arrives at that island to consult him and try to get him to help with the resistance. Probably gives the performance of his career. He's mostly known as a voice actor in recent years, and he never became the huge superstar Ford did on film.
Sure.
But he's very good in this film as Luke. He is torn. He's a man trying to escape his past. But of course, is they're trying to pull him back in. Carrie Fisher has a lot of scenes in this film. I was quite surprised with how many scenes they got done with her over a year ago before she passed away. And so people will enjoy that as well. I thought the film was too long. It's 2.5 hours long. It's the longest of all Star Wars films. But the characterization is deeper in this film than in some of the other films. That's what I liked. And it's one of the best-reviewed Star Wars films ever. And I think it is one of the two or three best Star Wars films that I've seen, if I had to rank them. We don't really talk about the prequels. They were so bad. But Rian Johnson, the director, does a very nice job with the effects. He does an especially nice job with the character development, which with kind of the deep problems, the deep conflicts that these characters have within them on what to do and what not to do in battling the bad guys here. So I think that really works well. It's a little too long. There have been some complaints. I'm not going to go into this spoiler, but some of the fan base is particularly upset with some of the characterizations in the film, a couple of the new characters. I think this is just ridiculous. These are people that are too into Star Wars. they hinge on every plot point. Who are Ray's parents? That's a big cliffhanger from episode 7.
Sure.
But I enjoyed this film and thought it was very well done. There is some blowback from the fan base on some other things that you'll see in the film that we can't get into here. But I overall thought this was a very good Star Wars film, and I'm not a Star Wars nerd. I must say that right away.
And like you mentioned, Carrie Fisher did pass away now. And now, am I correct in remembering that they've said they're not going to CGI her for any future films? This is her last appearance.
I think this is her last appearance.
Okay.
Whether there's going to be other last appearances or not, people are going to have to go see this film. there are some big surprises in the film. It's a hard film to review because you can't reveal spoilers because people get so upset, and I don't like to do that anyway. People need to see the film. But I thought there was a little bit of a narrative sag in the middle, I thought. There's a lot of cross-cutting going on in the film, different locations, different planets, different people trying to do different things. But overall, I think this was a pretty solid entry. What's interesting, Ashley, is on Rotten Tomatoes, the critic score is 93%. The audience score is 57%. That's very unusual for a Star Wars film. And that, again, points to what I was saying. There is some negative reaction amongst the really, really hardcore fan base about a couple of the characterizations and a couple of plot points and some other things that go on. So that's very interesting that we're seeing a flip of what you usually see with Star Wars reviews, which are usually not in the 90 percentile amongst critics, and they're definitely not as low as 57% with audiences usually.
You've mentioned a couple of times that there is a little bit more character development in this one than previous Star Wars. How are the effects, though? Because a lot of times you go for the effects. Are they still...
They're still top flight. There's no expense spared in this. The effects are good. They look like effects from other Star Wars films. But again, I think the real key to this film is the deep characterizations of Kylo Ren, Rey, Daisy Ridley, again, very good as Rey. She's a great new star. I think they hit the jackpot when they cast her, Ashley, having a female-driven Star Wars, which again is some of the blowback from the really, really hardcore fan base, unfortunately, in my opinion. But she's great in the film. Hamill is great. And Adam Driver is just – they really hit it out of the park when they cast him as Kylo Ren.
All right, here is some trivia. Star Wars Episode IV came out in 1977, so the Academy Awards of 1978. Why don't you tell me all of the ones that Star Wars – one, and then the additional ones that are nominated for.
Music score, I believe it won for.
Yep.
Is that right?
Yep. Best music, original
visual
score.
Visual effects or special effects, they might have called it then. Sound.
Yep.
Editing.
Film editing, yep.
Did it win cinematography?
It did not.
I'll say art direction, though.
It won art direction. Okay. Yep, and costume design.
So six.
Yep, it won six. Okay. And then it was also nominated
Best
for...
Best Picture, George Lucas for screenplay and director, did not win. Alec Guinness, supporting actor, did not win. Am I missing any others?
There was a special achievement award that year.
For the man who created R2-D2 and those
for Ben Burtt.
Ben, that's right.
Yep, there you go. All right, we've been in the movies with Matt O'Lane.
To innovate, you must first start with an idea.
Anything is possible.
An engineering college in Lima designed a giant advertising billboard that absorbs air humidity and converts it into purified water.
Hi, this is Guy Raz, host of the TED Radio Hour on NPR. I'm inviting you to join me every Sunday here on Prairie Public.
In Silicon Valley, no one even takes you seriously unless you've had two failed startups. In other words, we're raising our girls to be perfect, and we're raising our boys to be brave.
Every week, we pick a theme, and we interview some of the greatest inventors, thinkers, writers, and artists from around the world.
If you analyze the skull and crossbones and Blackbeard's other design strategies like that, it's clear he was a very, very smart designer indeed.
People who've given TED Talks on technology, entertainment, and design.
If we start now, we can be ready for the next epidemic.
We examine fresh approaches to new problems, and we explore astonishing ways of thinking. Gilligan's Island. Apparently, it's one long parable. That's the TED Radio Hour, every Sunday at noon Central, 11 a.m. Mountain, on Prairie Public, with me, Guy Raz.
This is Dakota Daybook for December 22nd. It was 1912, and the holiday season was well underway in the community of Britain, North Dakota. Mr. R. Welch gave a well-attended and festive dancing party, and the first snow of the season had adorned the rolling countryside of Burleigh County, giving the opportunity for sleigh rides. While May and Elva Doan visited with neighbors, Jewel Doan, along with C.A. Anderson and Herman Olson, ventured out into the newly anointed hills to hunt rabbits. With Christmas dinner only a few evenings away, the hunting party bagged 32 rabbits. These holiday celebrations may seem like a step back into a pastoral ideal, a time before checkout lines and parking lots. However, Doan family descendants can be found today on the same land that was homesteaded over 130 years ago. Today, the Black Leg Ranch is a thriving family farm and cattle ranch. Although the town of Britain is now nothing more than a memory and a name, its geographical location is within the Doan Ranch. The 17,000-acre ranch began as a sod house on a 160-acre homestead. It was founded by George Doan in 1882. Hailing from Ontario, Canada, George was one of the earliest homesteaders to break ground in North Dakota. Today, the ranch is run by George's great-great-grandson, Jerry Doan, and his family. While carrying on their ancestors' tradition of hard work, the Doan family has also been exceptional stewards of the land, strong-willed and forward-thinking, championing new soil conservation techniques and grazing systems, building soil health, and protecting the diverse wildlife communities that call their acres home. Agriculture has grown and evolved a great deal since 1882, and the Doan family's commitment to their land reflects this change. No longer just a piece of property producing commodities, the land is respected and attended to with care. Jerry Doan and his family were recognized for their efforts in 2016, receiving the first ever North Dakota Leopold Award. The honor is named after the renowned father of wildlife ecology, Aldo Leopold. In his celebrated book, The Sand County Almanac, Leopold championed the land ethic concept, saying that the individual is a member of a community of interdependent parts. The land ethic simply enlarges the boundaries of the community to include soils, waters, plants, and animals. This particular time of the year, when we celebrate and honor our loved ones, neighbors and friends, perhaps also remember to give thanks for this greater community championed by Leopold and the Doan family. As Mr. Leopold states, when we see land as a community to which we belong, we may begin to use it with love and respect. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Maria Witham. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Everyone's living on social media these days. And hey, so is Prairie Public.
Me love and friend come to visit.
Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and
Twitter
at Prairie Public.
They take pictures of themselves, and no surprise, they post them to Instagram.
You'll find television and radio content and behind-the-scenes views of Prairie Public via Facebook Live.
While we're live on Facebook, time for another movie review with Matt O'Lee.
Interact by sharing your thoughts, opinions, and photos. Just not your cat photos.
Talk to Prairie Public. We want to hear from you.
Want to know what's happening around North Dakota? Well, aside from listening to the What's Happening segment Thursdays on Main Street, you can peruse the events section at prairiepublic.org and plan your fun. You can find out more about things like an art exhibit opening, concerts, or even a potluck supper. Whew, there is lots to do, and prairiepublic.org is your one-stop shop to get the scoop on all the cool things happening in North Dakota. And northwestern Minnesota and eastern Montana, of course. And best of all, if you've got an event you want everyone to know about, you can submit it. And who knows, maybe it'll be featured on a future What's Happening. So just go to prairiepublic.org and look for the events tab.
That's it for this Friday edition of Main Street. Coming up Monday on the show, Christmas Day, Main Street is preempted as we air the final special from Vinyl Cafe. The beloved host, Stuart McLean, died early this year, but before his death, he recorded one last story, and we air that this Christmas Day. Until then, enjoy your holiday weekend.